It's a sad thing about the human condition that we get terribly upset when there is a bad thing happening, and then we are absolutely silent when the good news has come through. You might recall that when South Africa was put onto the grey list, that's 2.5 years ago, there was all kinds of fire and brimstone was going to happen to our country. Well, the good news is we're nearly off it. And the man who has been charged with doing that is the former acting Director General of Treasury, Ismail Momoniat. He joins us today. I was at the budget where you were given this responsibility and told by the finance minister that it would be your, even though you went off into retiring, that you would still be charged with getting South Africa off the grey list. And you're nearly there. This must be a sense of great relief.
Well, let me just start by saying the minister said I can't retire until we're off the grey list. And let me say, I want to be off the grey list, but I don't want to retire. I still want to do work. But yes, it's a great relief. I think we're almost out of grey listing. And we just face a 2-day on-site visit to verify the 22 action items. It's a very quick scan, apparently. It's not as hard as what we had to do the past 2 years. So I'm pretty confident that at the FATF, FATF's plenary meeting in October, that we will be delisted from the grey list.
How did we get onto it in the first place? And why was there such a panic when that happened?
I think, firstly, it was not expected at the time. But looking back, we should have expected that. I think that it was a clear result of state capture and the weakening of our institutions. And if you recall, even in 2015-16, we tried to get the FICA Amendment Bill. And President Zuma, in fact, had great objections over that bill. Firstly, it got delayed through the cabinet process for a year. And even when it went through to Parliament, and when he had to sign it into law, he referred it back to Parliament. He claimed that there were constitutional deficiencies, but, you know, we were able to address whatever concerns. But there was big resistance to the concept of politically exposed persons being formalized in that bill. In fact, we had to change it to, I think it was politically influential persons. So there was resistance, and that's just an example of the resistance. And so when we had our mutual evaluation, which is the peer review that the Financial Action Task Force, or FATF, does every 7 or 8 years, we are one of 40 members currently, but they do it to all countries that want to be part of the financial system, which, as you know, is globally integrated. So whether you're in FATF or not, you want to go through a mutual evaluation. And when we went through that mutual evaluation, we were found to be deficient on what the FATF does is it looks at two measures. Firstly, on the legal framework. FATF has 40 standards, what it calls 40 recommendations, and we were found deficient in 20 of the 40. So we had to make adjustments to our legislative framework. And then on effectiveness, which dealt with implementation, it won't surprise you to know that that's always a challenge, as we know, in our country. And we fail on all 11 measures. We got what was called a moderate rating, which is a fail, like getting 30%. And then we, on the other 8, we fail miserably. So, you know, we fail all 11, what's called immediate outcomes, but those were the effectiveness measures. So we kind of failed so badly that we were then put into a 1-year observation period, where we were able to bring together two major amendment laws, which, by the way, has helped us greatly, but we were still found wanting on implementation. And that's what we had to then deal with. And on implementation, I think it was So you know, I think we got there directly as a result of state capture, of the reluctance of the former president and cabinet at the time to update our laws, because FATF requires you to continually update to any changes in their standards. You know, we had one, a mutual evaluation in 2010, and we did fine on that one. But we didn't update our laws. And secondly, on effectiveness, remember, you know, state capture was about the deliberate weakening of the police, of the AUCS, or the DPCI, of the National Prosecuting Authority, of SARS, and many of our institutions. So we were actually lousy preventing and implementing, or preventing and enforcing the laws that applied, and to deal with financial crimes.
Yeah, and particularly money laundering, which the criminals love. They love it when you've got weak money laundering laws, and the combating of financing of terrorism. So those were the two areas. I guess the fact that we're getting so close now to leaving the grey list after being in such a parlous state says a lot about the progress of our country, despite all the noise around, since we were put on the grey list 2.5 years ago.
Yes, absolutely. I think, look, the grey listing has actually, you know, in retrospect, it's been good for South Africa, because it got us to do what we needed to do for the country's sake, not for FATF's sake, for our own sake, to deal with financial crimes. But let me also say that getting off the grey list doesn't mean we've solved all our problems and we can now live happily ever after. As you know, we have many criminals who, you know, somewhere along the line still managed to escape justice. Investigations were taking too long. There were problems sometimes in them getting prosecuted, and certainly in our judicial system, there seem to be challenges about how to deal with these sophisticated financial crimes. What exiting from the grey list means, because we had the two last items that were outstanding were always going to be the most difficult, but they dealt with a sustained increase in investigations and prosecutions, firstly for serious and complex money laundering, and secondly for terror financing. Now, what getting them, you know, the fact that we've passed the test in those and other action items, as they call by FATF, simply means that we've now, you know, put in place a system where we can deal with such crimes, that there's sufficient resources, there's sufficient expertise, we've started to get the expertise, and we've started to demonstrate the will to enforce the law. The worst lesson to take out, as I said, would be to say everything is now hunky-dory, we're all good. It actually requires us now to build on what we've developed up to this stage. And by the way, for South Africa, we fortunately or unfortunately, we have our next mutual evaluation next year. Because the previous one was in 2019, and you know, there was a bit of a delay in greylisting us because of COVID. So next year and 2027, when the outcome of our mutual evaluation will be published, we've got to obviously avoid being greylisted again. But more than that, I think we need to demonstrate that our system is functioning. So there's going to be, I think, some healthy pressure on us to continue to build on from the base that we've established currently.
I was just thinking this through, because last week I had a conversation with the head of fraud at one of the major banks, and he said that crypto is now becoming an increasing part of the criminal's armory. Is that something that the anti-grey listing efforts will be addressing? Or is it almost like, well, you know, the criminals have now got Bitcoin, so they don't really need to do their money laundering through the system as they had in the past?
No, absolutely. Look, I think when we got grey listed, what the FATF was finding that our system was firstly not up to date from the legal framework perspective, and secondly was probably not agile enough. And they were looking at new technologies as well. So if you take certainly the crypto world, the dark web, or even simple hawaladas, getting their funds outside, those are the kinds of different technologies that, and we did find when we, for example, looked at how our authorities were dealing with those types of crimes, that clearly the expertise was definitely not there. And they weren't even looking there because it was perhaps not on their radar screen. Now they've been forced to look around their radar screen as well so that they can meet up with these challenges. And look, just saying that is not going to help us meet the challenge. I think one does need, certainly in certain sections, quite a culture change. And by the way, not just with investigators or prosecutors or regulators, I would say even with our judicial officers. I'm not a legal person, but my guess is, you know, somewhere I read a statistic that in many countries, at least 80% or more of the evidence now is digital in nature. I mean, even a person who commits a murder presumably has a cell phone in his pocket, and I can say he's because almost all instances, it's men who do this. So there's a cell phone. So is a system able to take into account digital evidence? I mean, when you look at some of these prominent cases on our TV, for example, you see that the burden of proof, to me as a layperson, seems incredibly high. Just to show simple locations with your mobile or your mobile, and really, once you get to more difficult issues, I mean, if you look at the Babita Deokaran murder, you know, some of the sterling work done by people like Jeff Wicks, when they collected her laptop and other devices from the police, they actually found that they hadn't been opened for 7 months. Okay. And once they got hold of the laptop, they were able to, there wasn't even a need for, from what I understand, any sophisticated analysis of her laptop. She had an email saying exactly who she thought was sort of doing underhand things in procuring from Tembisa Hospital. So it looks like, you know, I mean, as you know, and given, I guess, our age as well, that people who are afraid of technology just kind of, I just prefer to be blind about it and don't go into it. Now, that's the kind of culture change we need. It requires a lot of education, a lot of training about how to use all the information that's available. In fact, if you look at our action plan, you know, the two outstanding ones were almost like the final output that the country had to show. But before that, there were things that were really, you'd almost think obvious, like the inputs rather than outputs. So one of our action items, IO6, okay, to use their numbering, was that SEPs regularly requests information from the FIC, the information from the suspicious transaction records or cash transaction records. Now, you'd think the police would have been doing it. What FATF also requires is not us just saying, oh, no, the police are doing it. We had to demonstrate that the police actually have in their standard operating procedures that there's a few pages devoted to this, or it's in their training manuals. And so that a police officer generally dealing with financial crimes would know that if they want more information, that they would go to the FIC. Now, you'd think that's the obvious thing to do, but it was in our action plan. And I think the good thing is now the police have started doing that and it's been done more systematically. What FATF does, by the way, is they then check with the FIC. Firstly, they ask the law enforcement, tell us when you ask the FIC for such information. And then they ask the FIC, show us all the requests that came from the law enforcement authorities. So that's a pretty simple one. Okay. I'll give you another one, which is about beneficial ownership registries. We just didn't have it when we did the mutual evaluation. So what we had to do is to establish the registries and now at least, and the important thing is for the law enforcement authorities to be able to access such information and to be able to do it pretty speedily. So I think all of those mechanisms are in place. But, you know, in a way, we need a culture where there's continuous learning. So when you're dealing with crypto, again, we need to get the best experts, look at the tools that are available. How can we improve the tools so that you don't have a kind of Pepita Tukaran situation where though the immediate people who committed the actual killing seem to have been apprehended and the police did very well there, it becomes much harder to work out who was behind those murders and who were the people who were unduly benefiting from the tenders from the Department of Health in Tembisa Hospital.
What interesting insights that you have on these issues. I just wonder, though, when you have a look at the peer countries, if you like, it was interesting to see that Mali and Tanzania came off the grey list in this last plenary. Now, Mali, I don't know if you followed the news this week, but sure, that's a country where the government has a coup, got rid of the elected government, and now they've just taken over one of the biggest gold mines in the world from Barrick Mining, biggest gold miner, and they are stealing the gold and taking it for themselves. And yet they're off the grey list. What happens now? Would presumably FATF would then have another look at Mali at the next time round? Or what is the process?
So, look, the FATF process is a very limited process. I mean, we get the same issues. People say, but how many people have come to court to face state capture allegations, okay? And yes, not as many as should be the case. And what I started saying is that getting off the grey list doesn't mean you solved all your problems. It just means the mechanism is there and the political will hopefully is there. So if you take a country like Mali, they've been on the grey list, as I understand it, for a long time. And look, being developing countries, perhaps their action plan was more basic in a sense that, you know, they take into account where you're at a low level and kind of try to get them up to a certain level. So it still reflects past success, but that doesn't mean there aren't problems. There certainly are problems. In fact, part of the problem that I see with the FATF process is that too many low-income or least developed countries are getting grey-listed. So I didn't check the actual count for this interview, but, you know, for example, say there were 22 or 23 countries that are currently grey-listed. What you'll find is more than half up on our continent. So take away South Africa, take away Nigeria, take away Kenya. Certainly we need to have financial systems that other countries or other financial institutions in other countries can rely on. But when you look at Mali, you look at Mozambique, you look at Burkina Faso, you look at, you know, many, many countries, including countries where there are conflicts, I would argue there's no point even graylisting them. They've got bigger problems to deal with. And I think the Fatah has begun to take that into account. You have a country like Haiti, also graylisted. Now, when they don't have very functional governments, it's almost like anything goes. So, yeah.
Well, it's been fascinating picking up with you, and thank you for your insights on this. It is progress. We've had a few wins recently here in South Africa, not just our cricketers. On the financial side, to be getting off the grey list is a big deal for people in the financial services sector. And the man who's been driving the process, Ismail Momaniat, thank you for the efforts that you've done in your national service. A lifer at the Treasury, haven't you been?
But let me emphasize that it was teamwork, and really the team pulled through. And I think the lesson is, can we build on where we're leaving off as we leave the grey list? There's much work still to be done. Because, state capture may have ended, but corruption hasn't ended, and it's become quite deeply entrenched, and we do need to take strong steps.
Well, we do have a center of excellence at the Treasury, the Department of Finance, and Ismail Momaniat is part of the reason for that. He's the former acting Director General of Treasury. I'm Alec Hogg from biznews.com.